DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet. I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on today's show, Colombia's impressive wildlife has survived civil war. Can it now help save the country's forests? Alien iguanas are invading the US state of Florida with dramatic results. Plus, why Southeast Asia's longest river could be destroyed in just a couple of decades. That's coming up. Stay tuned. Colombia is one of the world's richest countries when it comes to bird life. About 20% of the world's bird species can be found in the South American country. But until recently, much of this wildlife was inaccessible to visitors due to the violence in the countryside. Now, as Colombia's civil war winds down, former conflict zones are becoming world-renowned bird-watching spots, and conservationists hope that this hobby will help preserve the country's forests. Manuel Rida reports from Farallones National Park, Colombia.
A group of tourists snap away as they spot a bright red-chested bird with a multicolored jacket and grey neck. I'm told by a local guide it's the toucan barbet, and it can only be found in certain pockets of Ecuador and Colombia. The tourists I'm traveling with have come all the way from China. They're on a two-week bird-watching tour of Colombia that includes a stop at the Farallones National Park, a cloud forest just an hour's drive from the city of Cali. For Kun Liang Wu, it's his first time in Colombia.
We saw a lot of beautiful birds, which is amazing. Some toucans, some hummingbirds surprised me. This is a tropical place, but it's in high altitude. So we got different kinds of birds and all kinds of creatures.
Colombia has more bird species than any other country, according to BirdLife International. But until recently, many areas of the countryside were run by gangs or rebel groups, making it impossible for tourists or researchers to access the bird life. The Farallones National Park was a famous hideout for Colombia's notorious FARC rebels. The guerrillas kept hostages in this forest and blew up a nearby power plant. Luis Alberto Cortés has seen a lot in the 30 years he's lived here.
We used to have many armed groups here, including the FARC and the paramilitaries. If you came from Cali or other places, you could get kidnapped. You had no guarantee you'd get out of here alive.
Gradually, the Colombian army managed to gain an upper hand and push the rebels out of the national park, making the forest safe again for tourists to enter. Christopher Calonch has been given bird watching tours in this part of the country for the past 8 years.
Things are rapidly changing in Colombia, and now the locals have the opportunity to receive tourists from all over the world and make a living doing it. We believe that this is a great way to conserve these forests, because if the local community benefits from ecotourism, they're going to protect the forests where they live.
In 2016, the FARC guerrillas and the government signed a peace deal that ended 52 years of war. Calonge says he's now taking bird watchers to locations that are even more remote and were recently abandoned by the FARC rebels.
We've been doing tourism for 8 years, and we still have clients that come back year after year, and we always have something new to show them. Colombia is incredibly diverse. The landscapes are incredibly diverse.
But the end of the war also created new problems for Colombia's forests. Researchers say that some of the guerrilla-occupied areas have since been replaced with loggers, road builders, and cattle ranchers who are chopping down the forest. Osvaldo Cortés is an ornithologist for Pro Aves, a foundation that focuses on preserving the country's birds. He says deforestation is affecting the reproduction of some species, like the Crax alberti, a pheasant-like bird that only lives in Colombia.
When deforestation happens, the climate gets hotter in surviving pockets of forest, and that can affect nesting rates for some species, making it harder for them to reproduce. The birds also become more vulnerable to predators.
According to the IUCN Red List, 119 of Colombia's bird species are under threat. One of these birds is the rare blue-bearded helmetcrest, a hummingbird that is endemic to Colombia, but has already lost half its habitat.
That is very dangerous for an endemic species that is limited to a small ecosystem. Unfortunately, this ecosystem is being destroyed, not just by armed groups, but by indigenous communities that are burning the forests where this hummingbird finds the flowers it needs to sustain itself.
Conservationists are hoping that bird watching and ecotourism can help to roll back this trend somewhat by presenting communities with a new way to make an income from the forest. Hernando Garcia directs the Humboldt Institute, Colombia's largest environmental research center.
I think our country has a huge challenge, and it's finding ways for forests to contribute to the development of communities. Ecotourism is one way to do that, but there are others, like selling renewable forest products and creating value chains. There's a lot of research to be done in this area, not just scientific studies, but economic studies.
Birdwatching is only a small part of the tourism industry in Colombia, but as more tourists visit the country, people are finding ways to make a living from it. At the San Antonio Cloud Forest near the city of Cali, Raul Nieto has turned his small farm into a birdwatching center with dozens of feeder stations. Every day, some 30 tourists visit, each paying $5 to see the birds.
I think the number of people who visit has grown by 20% since last year. It's not just Colombians. We get people from Japan, from China, from South Africa, and India.
Nieto's farm is surrounded by cloud forest. This part of the forest is protected, and cattle ranching has been banned for the past 10 years. That's helped to keep the forest healthy, and it attracts more birds. The number of species sighted at this reserve by bird watchers has actually doubled in a decade, from 108 species in 2007 to 289 last year, according to eBird, a digital platform. Nieto says this encourages him to keep up his work.
A lot of this reserve is made up of private land, but we have learned to follow the rules. We don't have cattle here. We don't chop down trees. The idea is to preserve this forest. There are also rivers that have their headwaters here.
Raul Nieto's farm and the surrounding cloud forest are just a small corner of Colombia. As the country welcomes the outside world after years of violence, conservationists hope that Colombia can balance its economic interests with the need to preserve its forests. I'm Manuel Rueda for DW in Cali, Colombia.
Native to Central and South America and parts of the Caribbean, green iguanas have been spreading across the US state of Florida after escaping or being released by pet owners. Other voracious invasive reptiles such as the Burmese python and Argentine black and white tegu lizard have been the headline grabbers, but the iguana is similarly damaging to native species. Parts of Florida now swarm with them, and wildlife experts say the problem is only getting worse as iguanas reproduce at an alarming rate. Maria Bacalapolo went in search of green iguanas and has this story.
Another one. We could be passing green iguanas right now up here in these sable palms. They tend to like the fronds, be back in. Green iguanas are perfectly camouflaged to be hidden in that type of environment. I'm sure we're walking past an iguana or two right now.
Where'd you go, little fella?
My name is Tom Rahill. I belong to the Swamp Apes. We're known for python hunting. Unfortunately, we have a new side job. Iguana hunting. Iguanas, though they're not as dramatic as the pythons, are certainly as devastating in their own way to Florida's natural environment. We take veterans out on python hunting. We're now taking veterans out on iguana captures, tracking, and removal. I have with me in the vehicle an iguana that we got yesterday. This is the third one in a month. Oh, ho, ho. Here we go. This is a green iguana, a little fellow, but they're causing a big problem out there in the Everglades.
Along Florida's canals that lead to Biscayne Bay, you'll see hundreds of iguanas sunning themselves on boats and burrowing along the sea walls. Some homeowners take matters into their own hands, taking pot shots at the iguanas to scare them away and protect their expensive landscaped gardens. Without any natural predators here, iguanas flourish in South Florida. They are much more than a nuisance. They are causing serious infrastructure problems that could even cause flooding in some areas. Walk around a park or look up in the trees along the canals. You'll see iguanas. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission are offering workshops to teach the do's and don'ts for shooing away iguanas and discouraging their return, beginning in the Florida Keys.
And it's a common misconception. Oh, they look cool. Oh, they don't really hurt anything. The reality is that they are a plague that's been unleashed on our ecosystems. So when people see iguanas, what they see is this neat-looking lizard. What they don't understand is the damage that they create.
Sam Van Leer is president of the Urban Paradise Guild, an organization dedicated to removing and combating invasive plants in South Florida and restoring natural habitat through volunteer programs. Iguanas are a constant challenge in his replanting efforts.
I've seen iguanas go from a concern to overrunning new areas and spreading into new areas. So there's an infestation that's been growing. I would say over the past 5 years, it's been getting significantly worse. And so they're actually credited with wiping out one of the last known colonies of the Miami blue butterfly, which is a critically endangered butterfly found nowhere outside of South Florida. And they ate all of the larval food plants, all of the caterpillar plants that this butterfly requires in its life cycle. They literally can't live without these plants.
Cold snaps are the only natural limitation on the iguana population here. In order to be effective, the temperature needs to be near freezing and sustained for at least 4 to 5 days to kill significant numbers. The most recent significant cold snap was in January 2018, when a so-called bomb cyclone brought unusual cold temperatures to the East Coast.
We have this phenomenon we call here in South Florida, called raining iguanas. You come out here during a really cold day in the morning, and iguanas will be falling out of trees. They go into this torpid state because what iguanas do naturally is they go up into the tree to roost. That's their safe area. But as the night gets cold, they shut down. Being cold-blooded animals, their body temperature is very similar to the outside temperature. So as the temperature goes down to 40 degrees, their body literally shuts down. They lose their grip in the trees and they fall. So that's why you'll start seeing this sporadic iguanas falling out of trees where they're found. They'll turn gray in color, their eyes will sink in. It's a miracle how once they warm up, they'll come back to life.
And when they're not in trees, they're in the water, explains zoologist and communications director Ron McGill, as we tour Zoo Miami on a golf cart.
See, and they go down at night, they go down into these little rock crevices. There's another one behind them. See it? Oh, yeah. And like I said, the gorillas don't pay any attention to them anymore. Iguanas love water. You will often see iguanas on the banks of canals or on trees overhanging canals. And anytime they're threatened, they will not hesitate to just jump in the water, and they swim incredibly well. So the canal is almost like a freeway system for these animals.
They are also very effective breeders.
A big female can lay 30, 40 eggs at a time. So you have one female can lay those 30, 40 eggs, and all of a sudden you have more females. So the potential for reproduction is huge. I don't think we're going to get rid of iguanas. I think what we're going to end up having to do is, through research, find out how we can best manage the population.
Zoo Miami has been forced to euthanize its iguanas as a means of curbing their numbers. Iguanas can grow up to 5 to 6 feet with appetites to match.
So some of these areas are a lot more open now.
At the Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden in the city of Coral Gables, the rare exotic plants are fodder for the iguanas. Dr. Carl Lewis, director of the garden, points out a device used to protect their tropical Indonesian plants, a favorite of the iguanas.
There are hundreds of iguanas here in the garden. And you have to understand that we're trying to run a botanical garden and keep it beautiful and have rare plants here when we have giant vegetarian lizards running around. That's a big challenge for us.
There's one right here. Look at him. Look at him. See him? Right here on the edge? Yep. Oh.
Back at Zoo Miami, kids marvel at the iguanas hanging out with the primates. Despite the occasional cold snap, the iguanas are flourishing because of climate change and are moving further north, says Ron McGill. He predicts that in about 5 years' time, the iguanas may reach Orlando, some 380 kilometers north of Miami. But McGill says there could be a viable solution: eating iguanas.
It's ironic that South Florida has become kind of a melting pot for exotic animals. I like to call it the Ellis Island of exotic animals. They escape here in South Florida. It's like Club Med. I mean, they're out there and they're just enjoying this wonderful environment, no real pressures on them. The irony is that in places that they're found naturally in tropical America, for instance in Panama, they have farms for them because they eat them. They're considered a delicacy, a good meat. And I'm somewhat hoping that trend might take place here in South Florida soon, that people will understand that they can be a delicacy to eat, and they become an animal that can be eaten and thereby contribute a little bit more to the controlling the numbers for them here.
For DW, I'm Maria Bacalopolo in Miami.
At more than 4,000 kilometers long, the Mekong is the longest river in Southeast Asia. Over 70 million people living in 6 different countries depend on this river for their livelihoods. Large amounts of fish from the Mekong Delta are also exported overseas, including to Europe. But development is putting the ecosystem here under threat. Sand mines and hydroelectric power stations are changing the water quality, blocking fish migration routes and endangering the stability of the riverbanks. Environmentalists warn that the river, which has evolved naturally over thousands of years, could be destroyed in just a few decades. Chris Jansens reports from the Mekong Delta.
The mighty Mekong flows past Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh. Downstream, the river branches out into an impressive delta that goes all the way through southern Vietnam and ends in the South China Sea. The river is dotted with colorful fishing boats. But this river is in danger, and the problem lies beneath the water surface. The average annual load of suspended sediment in the Mekong River has dropped dramatically in the past few years. These are the fine soil particles that are naturally transported via the river's current. Nguyen Ho Tien, a Vietnamese independent expert on the Mekong Delta's ecology at the University of Kanto, has been doing research on this topic for over two decades.
The Mekong Delta has been built by the sediment transport process. During that process, accretion or deposition was always more than erosion. Only during the recent years, the erosion became very serious, and the delta's banks and the coast are retreating. And it's the first time in the history of the past 6,000 years. So I think in just a matter of centuries, the whole delta gonna disappear.
As a result of this process, he says, the lower Mekong Basin has seen an increase in landslides. I've come to Mae Hai Dong, a village in the Vietnamese province of An Giang in the delta of the Mekong River. The road that leads here has been blocked since April 2016. 57-year-old Toti Kim Hung recalls what happened.
I was washing vegetables in the river. The houses next to the water had cracked walls, and policemen were helping people evacuate their homes. Suddenly, I heard strange noises. A police officer shouted at me that I had to come out of the water. Seconds after I reached the riverbank, houses started to collapse into the water.
Amid the chaos, villagers managed to record the event on their mobile phones. Kim Hung says it all happened very fast.
In 5 minutes' time, 16 houses fell into the water right in front of my eyes.
Tran Van Bi owned one of those houses.
I wasn't at home when it happened. My wife called me on the phone. She told me I should come home as soon as possible. I arrived just in time to see the rooftop of my house sink into the river.
The ground suddenly collapsed into the river. It was unprecedented in the area.
I've been living here for a long time now, but I've never seen something like this. I think the sand mining causes these landslides.
Scientists agree that the sand mining is the main cause of these landslides, says Delta expert Nguyen Hu Tien.
The erosion landslide is mainly due to the deficit of the sediment budget. Sand mining deprives the sand from arriving downstream. And the most sand mining are in Cambodia and in Vietnam.
I traveled to Saang, more than 100 kilometers upstream in neighboring Cambodia. It used to be a quiet place along the Tonle Basak, a tributary of the Mekong River. But a few years ago, a sand mining company started digging here. Liu Lihut lives next to the dredging site.
The engines never stop. They don't even take a lunch break. The constant noise gives me headaches and a faster heart rate.
Here as well, parts of the riverbank have collapsed into the water. Sok Chang, another local resident, says half of his house already slid away.
My bathroom and toilet just fell into the water. It is actually not safe to stand here, as more parts of the house could collapse, especially when the rainy season comes.
But Sok Chang is trapped here.
I took a loan from the bank to buy this house. They only started dredging after I'd moved in.
The dredged sand is being used to fill up a drained lake at the site of a nearby luxurious apartment construction project. Environmental organizations are critical of the development. Meng Heng of the NGO Mother Nature claims there is corruption involved.
The official documents about the amount of sand are being forged. There is much more sand being dredged than officially permitted. According to a 2010 report by the NGO Global Witness, some 700,000 tons of sand have been dredged without permission.
Just after the report was released, the Cambodian government dismissed the claims as rubbish, stating the allegations were malicious. Sediment in the river is also being held back by the several dams that have been built on the Mekong. According to Global Witness, the structures can disrupt entire ecosystems. Further north in Cambodia's Tung Chang province, I visit the village of Kbal Romea, or at least what is left of it. A Chinese company recently invested in a dam that was built on the Seisan, another tributary of the Mekong. Now this village is slowly flooding. You can see the houses here are only just above the water. Vibol, one of the villagers, shows me around.
This is where I used to play as a child. Now it's just a flooded and empty area.
This territory is actually forbidden, especially for journalists. The government sees this area as a lake and has ordered the residents here to leave. But these people don't want to go.
Do you see the inscriptions on the houses? No LS2 dam. No Lower Sizan 2 dam.
People here are very attached to their houses, says Rang Lang, another local.
I won't go anywhere. All our ancestors have been buried here. We still pray to them. If I would leave, it would be a disgrace to them. I'll stay in this house till I die.
I am taken on a trip through a flooded forest. I see small sheds barely above the water, but then I realize this place is the cemetery. Song La shows me around.
Here we can still see the rooftops of our ancestors' graves. Further away, the cemetery is completely flooded.
The villagers are performing an old ritual next to a flooded shed. The late ancestors are being informed about what's going on. They are also being told about my presence. But how long can they continue living like this? The water is rising. They can't grow food and the fish are no longer edible, explains resident Samrong Nian.
Since the dam has been built, there is too much oil in the fish. We can't eat them anymore, otherwise we would get sick.
The dams here are having a devastating impact on the life of the fish in the river, explains environmental activist Meng Heng.
People along the river live from seasonal fishing. They catch the especially big fish. These fish tend to migrate for breeding, but the dams block their migration routes, so those fish will become extinct.
A total of 11 of these hydroelectric power stations are scheduled to be built on the Mekong in China, Laos and Cambodia in the next few years, explains Mekong Delta expert Nuong Hu Tien.
20 years ago, everybody thought that hydropower is a clean source of renewable energy. Only about until 10 years ago, people started to learn about hydropower impact. So it's understandable that the public and the government, are slow to learn until they see something real and learn the hard way. Ironically, the Delta is one of the most fertile areas in the world.
I am back in the Delta in Vietnam, where my journey started. Duon Cong To has been a fisherman in the Mekong Delta in Cam Tho for over 40 years. My father was a fisherman too. I learned everything from him. But when I started to fish back in 1976, the fish population was different than today. Some species became extinct. Cong To invites me for dinner. He serves lingfish. This is a species that lives in Cambodia, but comes all the way to Vietnam to breed. So you have to be aware of when and how to catch it. As we eat, he tells me an old saying.
Living on a mountain, you know when birds sing. Living on a river, you know how fish talk.
The question is if the fish, with all these changes taking place along the Mekong River, will keep on talking the same language. Environmental activist Meng Heng from Mother Nature is concerned about the future of the Mekong Delta.
It is difficult to know what the future will bring, but my concern is that a lot of people live along the Mekong River, and now we see that fish and tree species are disappearing. With these changes, the lives of the people will also change dramatically.
Chris Janssens, DW, in the Mekong River Delta.
That's all we have time for on today's show. In a couple of weeks, we'll be taking a close look at the topic of extreme weather, which is becoming more frequent and more intense due to climate change. And we at DW want to hear from you. Have you experienced extreme weather? How has it impacted your life? Share your stories, photos and videos with us on Facebook and Twitter using the hashtag #ExtremeWeatherStories. Or you can email us at extremeweatherstories@dw.com. Our program today was produced with the help of sound engineer Gert Georgi. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Until next week.